PRI's podcasts and on-demand audio are free, thanks to contributions from listeners like you. Make a difference. Invest in better media. Contribute at PRI.org. Thank you.
Today in Studio 360, Kim Burrell is a gospel superstar and pastor of her own church, but she's decided she won't just be preaching to the choir anymore.
What is our common ground of love outside of the four walls of the church? What is our conversation of love with people that are not of our fold?
It's 6 o'clock in the morning and I can already hear my life is calling.
But some people in gospel don't like their singers going pop unless they keep on evangelizing.
Their main concern is crossing over without taking the cross with them.
And later, a 25-year-old novelist named Taya Abret is the literary sensation of the season. But coming from the former Yugoslavia, she worries that success might be a bad omen.
In Balkan cultures, you find $5 on the floor, and the next thing you know, you are getting run over by a train.
That and lots more is ahead in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, after an all-American childhood in Colorado, a jazz saxophonist rediscovers his South Asian roots. And a 25-year-old writer who spent her childhood abroad before coming to America publishes her first novel, The Tiger's Wife. It's a bestseller that has blown away the literary world. But first, have you ever read T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland?
April is the cruelest month. Breeding lilacs out of the dead land.
That is Tom Eliot himself reading his poem.
Stirring dull roots with spring rain.
Published in 1922, it is the ultimate modernist poem, one of the most important and daunting works of 20th century literature. Weirdly, a new edition of the poem has just become a big bestseller in the iPad App Store.
Winter kept us warm. Covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers.
That's right. There's even an app for that. The Wasteland app was created by two British publishers, Faber & Faber, where Eliot himself once worked, and the new digital firm Touch Books. For $14, you get an enhanced electronic book for the iPad with readings by actors like Alec Guinness, Viggo Mortensen, and Fiona Shaw.
April is the cruelest month.
The famous first line aside, The Wasteland is a pretty intimidating text, thick with references to Sophocles and Ovid and Chaucer, Shakespeare, Walt Whitman, Aldous Huxley, Hinduism, Buddhism, popular songs from the 1920s, and tarot cards. English majors spend whole semesters picking apart its 434 lines.
I mean, I do think this app, it doesn't dumb down The Wasteland, but it definitely makes it feel maybe a little more alive.
Laura Miller writes about books and publishing for Salon.com. She thinks The Wasteland app is more than just an ebook with some extra bells and whistles. Its technology might actually change the way we read.
But it's not actually even really a book, it's an app. And that is something that may be based in a text, but is specifically designed as an app that you would interact
with. It's a very custom-made, bespoke thing.
Yes.
Just for the world of apps on iPad or otherwise. What, in your view, makes this such a leap forward?
Well, part of it is just the choice of material. And then you have all of these things that you can add to it. And they aren't extraneous to the poem itself, although, of course, you can just read the poem on the app if that's what you want to do.
But who would want to do that since you paid $14 for all this other stuff? So let's go through all that it can do. You have your iPad there. Mm-hmm. But so the poem comes up beautifully rendered typographically.
Yes.
You can have any of a half a dozen skillful, famous readers read it. Have the audio of them reading along with you as you read, right?
Yes, and that's a really nice thing that the app does. whichever reading you're listening to, you can follow along with the text, and the line that's being read will be highlighted.
Unreal city. Under the brown fog of a winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge. So many. I had not thought death had undone so many. Sighs, short and infrequent, were exhaled,
and each man fixed his eyes before his feet flowed up the hill and down King William Street to where St. Mary Woolnoth kept the hours with a dead sound on the final stroke of 9.
And it's a kind of an interesting and very targeted way to see different interpretations of the same poem, because one of the things many people don't realize is that a reading, you know, a vocal reading of something like that is an interpretation.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is this way that reading is a collaboration. It's between the reader and the author. And that's when you're reading it silently to yourself.
So this is a three-way. No.
Yeah. It's a three-way with Fiona Shaw, which may be more exciting than you really expected to get from a Wasteland app.
Stetson, you who were with me in the ships at Mylai. That corpse you planted last year in your garden, has it begun to sprout? Will it bloom this year, or has the sudden frost disturbed its bed? Keep the dog far hence that's friend to men, or with his nails he'll dig it up again, you hypocrite lecteur. Mon semblable. Mon frère.
Was there one feature that completely blew you away, or was it the whole package of stuff?
You know, I think it is really the video of Fiona Shaw's performance, because it is so striking. It's so beautifully mounted in every way.
Shot in some gorgeous little house in Dublin.
Yes, but it's also sort of crumbly and peeling and a little bit shabby, like it used to be grand, which is so perfect for the mood of the poem, which is about the decay of European civilization.
Yeah. Another feature that's here that I didn't even know I would love until I stumbled across it is the hand-corrected manuscript by Eliot of the poem.
Well, and it's also really important because The Wasteland was heavily edited by Eliot's friend Ezra Pound. And you can see Pound's remarks, which are so great. And part of what's great about it is that Pound is so unreverent of the work,
yes.
You know, and it's great to be reminded that this thing was in play once,
right.
You know, it didn't have to be like this. And
they were just two young guys trying to figure out how to make a poem.
And Pam would say, oh, that really doesn't work.
Right.
Or that's,
and the lovely just technically thing about it is that you can do the fingertip enlargement thing to read
to really
more closely.
See it. Yeah. Yeah.
Are there classic books that you think would be not so good to do this with?
I think that novels may be, unless you're talking about a very challenging modernist novel like Ulysses, but novels, especially with a strong narrative element, they're immersive.
Right.
You know, they're really, you don't want to really interrupt the narrative.
Right.
When I'm reading Great Expectations, I don't really care that much about which parts of it are based on Dickens' life or not. I just, while I'm reading that story is real to me, and I don't want someone to create any kind of distance.
Because it's attempting in its realistic traditional forms to create this immersive place where you're imagining you're in London in 1850.
Yes, and you don't want someone to break that spell.
Yeah. Laura Miller, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Laura Miller writes about and reviews books for Salon. You can see her personal list for other classics that she'd like to see get app editions at studio360.org. And while you're there, tell us what books you think might use an app like this. The tension between sacred and secular in black music goes back to the early days of Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles. Like in this scene from the 2004 biopic Ray, starring Jamie Foxx.
I got a woman way over town.
Ray.
She's good to me. Oh, yeah.
Ray.
She gave me money.
Ray, that's sacrilegious. It's a gospel song.
I know what it is. I wrote it.
But it ain't right to be changing gospel music, and it is.
And what? It devil music?
But that debate isn't just some quaint mid-century thing. It's still very much an issue for Kim Burrell. Her new record, called The Love Album, has been at the top of the iTunes gospel chart. But to me, the music sounds more like a hybrid of jazz and R&B than gospel. Eddie Robinson talked with Burrell about making her brand of music in the 21st century.
I keep hearing this medley in my ear. I keep feeling his presence so near. Music.
Daughter
so
of a pastor and an evangelist mother, Kim Burrell started her musical career in church, the Greater Emmanuel Church of God in Christ. She sang her first solo at the age of one. As a kid, she encountered more worldly music. Her older sister, Kathy, introduced her to MTV.
America!
It was the 1980s.
Demand your MTV! I want my MTV!
I want my MTV!
MTV hit real big when we were in our tender teens, and so that was a huge influence. I was a Wham fan, and then Police, Sting all together. We just fell in love with them. Phil Collins, oh, good night. Air Supply, all of it.
But as a young singer, she was firmly planted in church. She performed at churches and religious conventions all around the country. When she made her first CD in 1995, she sold nearly 50,000 copies out of the trunk of her car.
Oh, I hear you speaking.
Gospel is a pretty insular world with its own radio stations, record labels, and venues. But Burrell's voice caught the attention of artists outside the church, like Beyoncé and Harry Connick Jr. and Justin Timberlake. Whitney Houston blurbed her new record, calling Burrell one of the greatest voices of our time.
I spent this last tour, she was in Germany, and she flew me out there. I hung out about 6 days. We were in Munich, and she says to me, she addressed me as pastor. She said, right before we go out, I want you to pray for the cast for tonight. And I said, sure. And we all stood around right before we went out. She says, I'm glad you're here. She says, I've really, really felt like I needed this out here, because we prayed and we talked a lot. But she said to me, your voice, she said, I listen to it every day. You know that. I said, yeah. She said, but your voice gives me a different message every day for my personal life. It's that kind of thing that makes me revisit what my voice says or does to people.
And maybe Whitney Houston had an influence on Kim Burrell, too. Last year, she hired a PR team to help promote new endorsement deals, a reality TV series, a more attractive image, and the release of a non-gospel album. It's called The Love Album. The cover is a very feminine hot pink.
Do I speak or do I not? My insecurities have me paralyzed. Are you listening or are you not? Tell me, am I wasting my time?
Within Kojic, the Church of God in Christ, Burrell caused an uproar, as though the gospel star quarterback decided to play golf. There's a real suspicion of crossover in the gospel community, and maybe with good reason.
Their main concern is crossing over without taking the cross with them.
That's Shirley Caesar, a gospel legend who's won her share of Grammys.
The way I look at that is either you're hot or cold. But if you're lukewarm, then you're in trouble. The Bible said that he would spew you out of his mouth. A lot of the gospel radio stations are not really interested in playing traditional gospel. See, their backers are not interested in our kind of music. They are interested in anything that will sound as close to R&B as it possibly can. Their backers are really trying to pull us into love songs, and I just think that there should be a difference. I guess I'm in the I shall not be moved crowd. I'm just going to continue to sing my traditional gospel music.
The whole secular thing, I think why gospel and walls go up is a bunch of religious stuff that we've been taught and how to protect what is sacred about our belief in God. But I think they have not defined the word secular. They just heard blues music or the lyrics of the Baby Baby I Love You be labeled as secular music. And gospel, I think they put up a wall immediately to salvage what they feel makes them significant from everybody else.
But for Pastor Shirley Caesar, the suspicion of crossover is justified. A contemporary R&B sound is often a clue that a gospel artist is sweeping religion under the rug, trying to be spiritual but not devout.
This change in sound, music that is supposed to be singing about Jesus, but speak of him in the third person, I don't know, I just cannot appreciate that. I think that if we're talking about Jesus, his name should be mentioned somewhere in that song. If we're talking about the Lord God, his name should be mentioned somewhere in the song. I've seen a lot of that change.
I never forget riding in the car when I was a little girl, my favorite person to listen to that was considered a secular artist, Stevie Wonder.
Over time, I've been building my castle of love.
And about the age of 14, people started asking me to sing at weddings. Now, at 14, to go to a wedding, what does it sound like? Featuring Miss Kimbrell here at the wedding, singing the greatest hits of Mahalia Jackson. As these two are getting married, move on up a little higher. Nah, maybe Ribbon in the Sky. So, Ribbon in the Sky wasn't in the hymn book, but that's what I sang, okay? I was inspired by him to embrace love music.
Love me in a special way. What more can I say? Just love me.
The Love album features Kim Burrell's interpretations of traditional gospel, alongside covers of Earth, Wind, and Fire and the 80s R&B group DeBarge. Will the Love album gain her fans outside the church? It could be a little naive to think so. Fans of jazz and R&B might be scared off by religion. But even if non-believers don't come to the record, Burrell thinks Christians can learn a few things from a good love song.
Church and love, where do we stand? Are we limited to John 3:16? Is that the love we abide by in every way? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believeth in him will not perish but have everlasting life. Okay, I got that point. But what is the love that causes us to interact with each other and be real, be genuine, be honest, be fair, able to communicate outside of preaching, singing, pastoring even? What is our common ground of love outside of the four walls of the church? What is our conversation of love with people that are not of our fold? How do we interact with other religions, and where is our love in that?
Burrell recently became a pastor, so perhaps her musical mission has just begun.
So that's what the Love album is about. It's about expressing how I feel about life right now. It includes me expressing to the church that we need to show love in so many other ways.
It's never too late to pray.
For Studio 360, I'm Eddie Robinson.
How do you feel about religious singers of whatever faith proselytizing in their pop music? Let us know at studio360.org. Coming up, a writer born in the former Yugoslavia discovers that Serbs and Croatians share something in common: fear of the undead.
You get rid of a vampire in Serbia the same way you get rid of a vampire in Croatia, and they may be different words, but it's the same thing.
This season's literary It Girl on her novel, The Tiger's Wife. And our listeners write their own obituaries. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On last week's show, I interviewed Timothy Shafford about his new novel, The Coffins of Little Hope. The narrator of the book is an 83-year-old obituary writer for her small-town newspaper in Nebraska. Inspired, we asked you to provide the preferred first sentence for your own obituaries. The novelist himself responded to our challenge with, "Having faked his death, Shafford is living comfortably in an exotic locale." And now, here are some of the best obituary one-liners we receive from listeners. They're read by their authors.
Hi, this is Roger from Connecticut. And the first line for my obituary should be, "Roger has spent his whole life working towards this moment."
This is Susan Champlin from New York City. "Everyone said she was nice, but they didn't know her that well."
This is Kim Dale in Chicago, Illinois. And the first line of my obituary is, "She disliked children until she had her own, who she loved so much she trembled."
My name is Leon Zitzer. I live in Manhattan in New York City. And the line for my obit would be, "Rumble, young Jew boy, rumble."
His father died on his 13th birthday on March 4th, 1983, but Tilly Gapadok somehow managed to live a happy and productive life anyway.
Hi, this is Rich Kelly in Brooklyn. And my line is, "His jokes seem a lot funnier now that he's gone."
This is Ginger Chamberlain from Alexandria, Virginia. And the first line of my obituary is, "Ginger's family invites those who knew her to come, raise a glass, and say, we'll miss her, or thank goodness she's gone."
Thanks to all of you for contemplating your deaths. It's still not too late to submit your own obituary, and you can do so at studio360.org. Taya Abret's first novel, The Tiger's Wife, came out a few months ago. The praise has been extreme and pretty universal for its sheer writerly skill as it shifts between realism and fairy-tale-ish fable, and for its sense of deep wisdom about memory, faith, family, death. And then there's the astonishing fact of Taya Abret's age. She's 25 years old. Earlier this month, she won the Orange Prize, which is given every year to the best English language novel by a woman. She is the youngest person ever to have won one. Taya Abret, you young person, you, welcome to Studio 360, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So there are several distinct stories going on in The Tiger's Wife. When somebody you meet on an airplane, let's say, asks you, "Well, so what's your novel about?" What do you say?
Well, I say that it's a novel that takes place in an unnamed province of the former Yugoslavia, which is where I'm from, and that it follows a young doctor named Natalia who is coming to terms with the circumstances of her grandfather's death, which are pretty mysterious, and involve her reflecting on stories that he told her about his childhood and about his time as a doctor when he met this vagabond named the Deathless Man.
Speaking of your grandfather, the character, the heroine of this book, has this very, very close relationship with her grandfather, which I presume in an emotional sense had some play on how you created this the character, i.e. your own relationship with your actual grandfather. Why was he such an important person in your life?
Well, he was, you know, he and my grandmother and my mom raised me. He was really the father figure in my life, and we spent a lot of time together. He was, you know, an extremely, in some ways, he was a terrifying man, and he seemed to terrify everybody but me, and he became extremely different around me. And I don't know if that had to do with age or the fact that people change when they have grandchildren as opposed to children, but we were always very close. We were pals. And it seemed like he set the moral bar very, very high without ever having to administer any kind of discipline. Mm-hmm. So you knew when you had disappointed him, and you knew when you were supposed to be doing something and you were doing wrong instead. And so he was a behavioral and emotional kind of gauge for what you were supposed to be doing with your life. And that stayed firm for the whole time he was alive, and still does, I think.
At what age did you begin writing fiction?
I started writing when I was 8. I wrote my first short story, and I was just sort of getting used to the English language, and I liked the way the word goat looked. It was a very attractive word for me. I thought that it had depth and many different kinds of letters. And so I wrote a short story about a goat. And we were living in Cyprus at the time. And my mother had this ancient laptop computer. And you sort of had to drum down on the keys with your fists. And I wrote the story. And I took it to my mother and said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to write.
And she said, sure.
That's great. Yeah. She was like, sure. All right. Yeah. And that became the path.
And is it true, as I've read, that one of the ways you learned English was watching VHS cassettes of old Disney movies?
Yeah, I learned English off of, you know, bootleg Disney movies, and I knew the dialogue, you know, from beginning to end. But I had no idea what the characters were saying, so I would go around like a parrot. You know, I'd walk around the house and repeat the lines of dialogue, which my mother found extraordinarily annoying.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we think of, the great mythic storytelling tradition of the Balkans and Eastern Europe and Egypt. But, you know, it sounds as though perhaps the Walt Disney Corporation's version of myth and fable might have been one of the influences that you drew on.
I think that it certainly is. I mean, I liked fairy tales as a child, and they were pretty good at adapting fairy tales. I do think, however, that there is such a thing as a Disney-fied fairy tale.
For sure.
And I think that I was always drawn, and I don't know what this says about me, but I was always drawn to the real fairy tale,
right.
You know, to the grim version of it.
The violent, sad, grim ones, yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, you don't exactly see, you know, in Snow White, you don't see the queen strapped into iron shoes and then forced to, you know, walk until she kills her, you know, until she walks herself to death. And
yeah.
I always, you know, thought that kind of macabre thing was fascinating. Like, how could people come up with this?
Yeah.
It's so awful. And I found it sort of richer and more complex, and it said more about people. And so I was more drawn to that version of the story almost always.
As you're writing this book, which veers and almost seamlessly shifts back and forth between these fable-like, mythic environments and events and fairly straightforward realism, is it tricky? Do you require a different kind of writerly trance to do those two kinds of writing?
I think so. I was never... That must be the case, because I was never able to switch from one section of the book to another in a single writing period.
Huh.
If I was writing a tiger section, I could continue with other tiger sections. You know, I could skip to a different section with the tiger and his wife. I could skip to a deathless man section, but I would not be able to skip back to one of Natalia's sections.
Right.
And Natalia's sections were written almost... all of them rewritten entirely after the book had already been through one round of edits.
Uh-huh.
Because I happened to go vampire hunting in Serbia and Croatia for a nonfiction piece that I did for Harper's.
Right.
And inadvertently did a whole bunch of research that I didn't realize I needed, but that enriched the book tremendously.
So wait a sec. Vampire hunting. Harper's Magazine sends you to the land of your birth and the land of vampires,
yes,
to do an article about the folklore surrounding them. When you show up there, do you feel like it's a homecoming, or are you just this American outsider doing an article?
I did feel like an outsider, but not because I was an American. And you know, the communication part aspect was not a barrier. It was getting people to admit to something, because people were very shy about their superstitions, and they were aware that this would be perceived as a superstition,
right,
and could potentially be a minefield of mockery.
Right.
The thing that people were most concerned about when we spoke to them about vampires and superstitions and beliefs was for us to understand that during Tito's time, during Tito's regime, none of these beliefs existed. And that was because people were stable and happy and didn't have a need for ridiculous notions of vampirism,
huh,
and superstitions. And several people told us this. most of them, you know, between the ages of 70 and 95. And it was very interesting. It was something that
That's fascinating, because, of course, as you know, in the 90s, one thought and then read that, of course, Tito kept, by being an atheist communist, kept a lid on all of these roiling religious tensions. But I never thought that he also kept a lid on the other half of the mythic superstition pot, about vampires and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, apparently, that has to do with the fact that I think religion, Christian, Judeo-Christian Muslim religion in its, you know, in its sort of blanket terms the way we see it today, that is predated by these deep pagan roots that persist from Croatia to Serbia to Bosnia to Slovenia to Montenegro, everywhere,
right?
Because they're very much the same. You know, you get rid of a vampire in Serbia the same way you get rid of a vampire in Croatia, and they may be different words, but it's the same thing. And that was a very fascinating thing to learn and very heartening in a way.
Yeah. So for the last few months, you have been and are the sort of it girl of literature. It's true. You can laugh, but it's true. Is that completely gratifying, or is there any downside at all, or is it just as wonderful and Cinderella-like as one might imagine?
The fact that the book exists and that people have read it is Cinderella-like. Because of my own personal nature, which is to doubt everything and fear everything, and, you know, immediately after a good thing happens, like, you know, in Balkan culture, it's you find $5 on the floor, and the next thing you pick them up, and right. The next thing you know, you are getting run over by a train,
right.
And because that is how the world works karmically. So I have, you know, I have some trepidations about
right.
about having this book afford me the life that I wanted. I mean, I wanted to be able to write, and now I get to write a second book, and that's ridiculous to me. And I, you know, somewhere deep in my core, I believe that that's going to come with some form of payment, and I
right.
really, really would rather not know what that is.
I think you have at least a couple of complete duds before they'll take away the chance. Tea Albrecht, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kurt.
Tea Albrecht's first novel, The Tiger's Wife, is out right now. So often we ask artists about works of art or entertainment that have changed their lives. Rudrish Manhuthappa plays jazz on alto sax. His album Raw Materials from a few years ago, a duet with the pianist Vijay Iyer, was on lots of best of the decade lists. Rudrish grew up in Boulder, Colorado. In the 1990s, when he was in his early 20s, he went to India on a music tour, his first trip there without his family.
So I was very, very nervous about going to India. I was like, I don't speak my parents' language. I don't speak any Indian languages. I was going to be confronting, oh, you don't speak Kannada? Oh, you're just an American boy. You know, like stuff from my extended family. I was at a point in my life where I was trying to figure out who I am. Am I American? Am I Indian? Am I neither? Am I both?
Which sounds a little confusing and stressful, but he went, and during his trip, he found himself in Bangalore in South India at an all-night concert, 8 p.m. to sunrise, by the classical singer Parveen Sultana.
I never heard anything quite as captivating since having first heard Charlie Parker or John Coltrane. I just couldn't believe her command of rhythm and her command of melody and her charisma. And there's something about the way she's singing this repetitive melody, and then she just improvises a little bit in between phrases. And it all just sounds so complete, and it sounds so effortless. God, I just love that. She's so awesome. I realized that I was as captivated by Indian music as I was jazz. And I felt it burn inside me the way that the music that I was already playing burned inside me. That kind of driving force, that propulsion is something that I want to feel all the time. Not only playing music, that's just something I want to feel in my body, in the way I conduct myself. It's almost like this track on many levels is kind of like a template for life for me, even though I don't understand the lyrics. It was the kind of the start of a longer journey of how to engage my ancestry on my own terms. Somebody sang to me, you know, somebody sang me a missing link. Somebody sang me like a large piece of a puzzle that I needed to kind of, you know, complete a picture to figure out who I am in this world.
Like to hear from you if some work of art really changed the way you see the world. Let us know at studio360.org and we may give you a call. Our story today was produced by Michael Rayfield. Coming up, the gay pride flag gets a makeover. Several makeovers, in fact.
It's maintaining the horizontal stripes, but just making them a little bit more bold and contemporary by putting a white border around them.
It already looks 10 times better to me.
Right. It keeps it the rainbow flag, but it separates it from all the copycats out there.
That's in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Well, there's a crazy daddy.
When I was in about third grade, all at once, the world of everyday stuff got new and exciting. Instamatic cameras and touch-tone phones and zip-top soda pop cans. Of course, those zip-tops 1.0 in the 1960s with the razor-sharp metal tags you ripped off the can and threw away were convenient and fun, but also kinda dangerous. That changed in 1972 when a young engineer was hired by the Reynolds Metals Company to help them get into the aluminum can business.
Well, he's the only one on the street. My name is Dan Kudzik, C-U-D-Z-I-K, and I'm the inventor of the Pop Top.
The newest beer can tops have ring tabs made of aluminum from Alcoa. Now beer cans are a cinch to open. Ring tab tops make them a cinch to open. Another change for the better with Alcoa aluminum.
Back in the 70s, when the Pop Top was born, we had to design a convenience top that was more practical and less prone to litter.
Take a Pop Top holiday. Get the Schlitz. Forget the opener. Schlitz Pop Top bottles. Schlitz Pop Top cans.
So we started out with the program at Reynolds developing this thing to the point where we can make a convenience top that was very reliable, and I think we've achieved it. I would go out for a ride in my car for 50 or 100 miles from Richmond, Virginia, down to the mountains, Appalachians, then come back and maybe have a better, more clear picture of what I wanted. This is how it happened. I was sitting in my living room, half watching the movie and half watching what I was trying to resolve. And all of a sudden, the pieces all fell together, and I told my wife unequivocally at the time, I says, I think I finally got the answer. And so I come upstairs, and I sketched it up for her, and then the following day, I went to work, and I sketched it up for my boss, who's retired now. So we went ahead, and we built the preliminary tools to approve the concept out, and I got it worked right away. The concept is initiated by a first-class and a second-class lever. If you were to take any youngster, show them how to lift the tab up, and then ask them what happens, it's amazing because people think it just opens because of the lifting of the tab, but it isn't. When you lift the tab, it flexes in back of the rivet. And then the nose causes the next action, which as this pressure point changes, that's what causes the opening to happen. Yeah, I'm putting the fingernail underneath there. Okay, and we take the thing. All you've done is you've fractured the rivet in back of the head of the lifting action. And as you continue on opening, it snaps all the way through and it's open. I think I had like 32 patents and can top business. We've improved on it from time to time, but I think we're at a point right now where I don't believe that there'll be too many changes anymore. They're reliable and they're pretty much effortless. I think we've more than proved that it's the most workable concept on the market.
Since its invention in 1972, Daniel Kudzik's Pop Tab has, by one estimate, conserved 500 million pounds of aluminum, and Lord knows how many thumbs. Kim Gittleson produced our story. A few years later in the 1970s, the rainbow flag became a symbol of gay pride. It was designed by a San Francisco artist named Gilbert Baker. Recently, the Federal Reserve Bank in Richmond, Virginia, of all institutions, in all places, decided to honor Gay Pride Month by flying the rainbow on its flagpole just below Old Glory. And, not surprisingly, they got a lot of angry responses. The flag is an emotional touch point for a lot of Americans. But we got to wondering here at Studio 360 whether that rainbow is just a little too 1970s. So we asked our listeners whether another kind of design might better represent the gay community in the 21st century.
It should be a symbol of love, maybe two hands together or...
something that was like more shocking or more memorable, perhaps.
Marching penises.
You could also do the complete opposite, which would be a very strong, simple, iconic black and white symbol.
Let me know if you change it, though, because I don't want to hang out the wrong flag.
A lot of people we heard from were unhappy that we even opened up this question. One of them posted comments under the name Chillhouse.
My name's Krista Hillhouse. I'm an artist and a musician.
Turns out Chillhouse is an actual rock star. Krista Hillhouse used to play bass for the band Four Non Blondes. And she read her letter for the air.
The flag doesn't need to be redesigned because it's not a new symbol that we should be looking for. It's new leadership. Redesigning the gay flag is completely irrelevant to our continuing struggle for equal rights. Nothing could come close to our current flag in its ability to represent such a large and diverse group of people all over the world. It's sacred. People have literally died for openly displaying it. Its 30-year history should be respected, and it should be left alone.
But other people supported what we thought was our good-natured, pro-gay attempt to rethink the flag.
I personally am not a huge fan of it. I'm gay, and I can say that without being, you know, you can throw you can throw whatever stones at me you want, but it's, you know, not my, it's never been my most favorite symbol.
Mark Randall is the lead designer at the design and marketing firm World Studio here in New York City.
One is...
We asked Mark and his team to work on some redesign ideas.
The rainbow flag. What can we do that it's still the rainbow flag, but just works better? You know,
how do you and after they did their work, Mark came here to Studio 360 to present World Studio's ideas for making over the flag.
The rainbow has too many other connotations, and just from a pure branding standpoint, there are too many other people that use basically the same imagery. So we've got the Rainbow Coalition that tried to co-opt it. You know, the Incas a long time ago had a similar rainbow flag.
What's the first step? What's the first thing you do to try to figure out a job like this?
Well, a job like this is like a dream job that probably no one will really ever get. But
until the gay government asks you to do this.
And it's a bit of a solemn task. I mean, we took this project very seriously. We didn't want to be glib about it.
Kind of very seriously. Mark brought in 8 different designs. And you can follow along and see all the ones he's referring to at studio360.org.
You know, we'll sort of start this process by looking at just these modifications of the rainbow flag. So the first one we did is really the closest to the rainbow flag. It's maintaining the horizontal stripes, but just making them a little bit more bold and contemporary by putting a white border around them.
It already looks 10 times better to me.
Right. It keeps it the rainbow flag, but it separates it from all the copycats out there, the other organizations that claim the rainbow flag as their image. Just to float these color bars within this white field makes it much more graphic, much more bold, much more distinctive.
Definitely.
So that's number one.
Mark's next idea was a single strip of different colored squares on a white background. There's something slightly like a modern medical test about it.
Right. It might look a little bit too much like Centrum Vitamins. You know, there's those Centrum Vitamins.
Yeah.
So it's maybe not one of my favorites, but we thought we'd show it. Because a lot of this is about process and exploring. And, you know, when we really present to our clients, they might respond to something that we hadn't thought of that would push the idea to a new level.
Right.
When we start a job, we come up with a list of keywords. And we always refer to these words when we're designing something because this is really the core of what we're trying to communicate.
So I had a list of keywords.
Oh, yes, keywords. We love keywords.
And throw some out there if you think of your own.
Well, Tom, you would add fabulous.
Well, yeah, that thing of the uniqueness.
Uh-huh.
But isn't that a separating word in a way?
Well, yeah.
Well, but
that's really enough. That's what I find very interesting.
So the next one, we've got a field of white with a beautiful, perfect, a nice round O, but it's all made up of a gradation of beautiful rainbow colors. I think this is actually a really powerful symbol. The circle is one of the oldest symbols, and it's resonant with every culture on Earth. You know, it talks about unity. It talks about individuality.
Well, and also because you have the blurring gradations between each of the colors, that seems somehow more apt.
Yes. When white light gets refracted into a rainbow, it doesn't get refracted into these perfect stripes. There's a blurring and a blending, which I think is a really important metaphor for this type of a flag. So let's move on to images. So kind of jettisoning the idea of the rainbow and just start talking about this idea of symbols. And one of the things, you know, that we looked at was this idea of color, because color is a symbol. You know, we thought that pink and lavender were just a little soft. You know, they weren't as aggressive and out there and loud as we felt the color should be. So what we came up with a color we call shock, which is, you know, and because it's the gay community, we just had to name our color. It just couldn't be, it just couldn't just be a color.
Pantone number.
Right. Well, it does have a Pantone.
It's as rich as a pink can be and still be pink.
Right. And it's actually really what's known as, it's like a magenta or like a shocking pink.
The rainbow colors.
There are no pink flags, really.
This is a really great page. These are the colors of all of these different flags.
Oh, that's interesting.
So here's the colors that are used, and here's this wonderful... And you're right, and
there's
I noticed
no
that,
pink.
Too. There's no pink.
It's already existing in the community and ownable and recognizable.
Right, this pink. Is it. I think when you don't see it on all of the other flags, like, what a great opportunity.
Yes.
To take pink before someone
So what we decided to do was propose this idea where you just co-opt every flag that's ever made, and you just print it in our color shock, in our magenta. So, and especially flags that are from groups that are typically homophobic.
Yeah, first of all, you have the big Old Glory all in pink, but then a highly provocative one that I think people would love to wear, depending on where they live, perhaps, the Confederate flag.
Right. And then we have the flag of Iran, a Christian flag, the Olympics. And anybody can do it.
Yeah.
You know, it really, it says that I'm part of this culture, but I'm also gay.
Right. It's interesting seeing in this scheme you have, you can either, as you said, choose the magenta background or this rainbow background. But just seeing the plain rainbow background, not the way the flag is today, but with the gradual gradations, that just by itself improves thing in my mind.
Yes, it's actually quite beautiful.
Yeah.
No offense to Mr. Baker, because, you know, we know that that flag came out of true passion, blood, sweat, and tears. And it's about, you know, looking, you know, just looking at ourselves and imagining what we could be. Or, you know, oftentimes, even with our clients, we'll do exercises where we'll do an exercise and they'll realize, like, you know, we're kind of okay right where we are.
Yeah.
And that's really valuable, too.
Would you be pleased if one of these actually got traction and virally was adopted by people and groups around the country and world?
Oh, we would be ecstatic. It would be like a dream come true.
And if people love it, I guess this is entirely open source.
Yes,
they can just use it.
Absolutely. It's a completely open source idea. Yes.
Great. Yes. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We're glad to have done it. It was a wonderful experience.
Well, it was a pleasure for us. You can see the new gay flag and signage that World Studio designed for us, as well as all the flags designed by listeners, at studio360.org. As for our listener, Krista Hillhouse, she shared another opinion with us.
What we need is an anthem. We don't need another flag, we need an anthem.
What do you think the anthem should be?
What's up? What else? I'm a little biased. And we were all dykes, man, you know. Sport on blondes, bunch of lesbians, hello. What's going on in our Sam? Hey, yeah, yeah,
hey, yeah, yeah. I said, hey, what's going on? And that's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen to the next one. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogeson, Michael
Guerriero, Eric
Malinsky, Sean Twigg,
Rachel Greenberg,
Katie Bierenbaum,
Liz Fiella.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the soundtrack to a revolution.
Hip-hop was certainly part of the musical score of life for the young people in Libya.
A Libyan-American poet explains how art and culture helped the Arab Spring bloom.
Politics better be as much fun as a party if we're going to be involved in it.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.